What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I have the great pleasure and privilege of speaking with Jonathan Lynn. Jonathan Lynn has directed 10 feature films, including the cult classic Clue. He also wrote the screenplay, which happens to be one of my all-time favorite movies. Nuns on the Run, which he also wrote. One of my other favorite movies, My Cousin Vinny, and The Whole Nine Yards. For television, Jonathan's writing credits include dozens of episodes of various comedy series, but he is best known for the phenomenally successful, multi-award-winning BBC series Yes, Minister, co-written and created with Anthony Jay. And his numerous awards include the BAFTA Writers Award, the Writers Guild, the Broadcasting Press Guild, the NAACP Image Award, the Environmental Media Award, the ACE Award for Best Comedy Series on U.S. Cable, and a special award from the Campaign for Freedom of Information. It was such a pleasure and honor speaking with him. As I mentioned, Clue is one of my all-time favorite movies, which I watched ad nauseum growing up. And I think I'll just leave it there. And now I give you Jonathan Lynn. Okay, I'm here with Jonathan Lynn. Jonathan, thanks for coming on the podcast, sir.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
Oh, my pleasure. This is a conversation I'm wanting to have for a very long time. I want to discuss your career, your life, Jonathan, the craft of directing. But before we get there, Jonathan, please tell our listeners briefly sort of who you are and what you do.
I was an actor, though I don't act anymore. I'm a writer, I'm a director of films, TV shows, plays. I've written novels, occasional journalism. That's about it.
Excellent. So I think most people probably have an idea of what a film director does, Jonathan. In your view, what would you say are the day-to-day responsibilities of the director?
Well, it's a huge job. You start off with trying to get the script right. Somebody may have sent you a script, or you may have written it yourself. You've got to negotiate the script with whoever's financing the film, which may or may not be a major studio, or maybe individual financiers. All of them will have their own views about what is good and what is bad about the script, and which I have to somehow try and keep what I think is good and ignore what they think is bad while not upsetting anybody. Then it gets to casting. Casting is pretty vital. And, of course, the script may have to change when you cast it. I made a film called Nuns on the Run that I wrote for two 22-year-old guys. And in the end, American guys, in the end it was played by Eric Idle and Robbie Coltrane, who are Brits and middle-aged.
Right.
So that was a big rewrite. I also originally said it in Boston, but nobody would make it in America. So I said it, rewrote it for England. And, you know, so that was another rewrite. So you do a lot of rewriting to suit the cast. The movie is only played once, normally. If you write a play, you hope that if it goes well, lots of other actors will play it in the future. But that doesn't really happen with movies. So you have to, if you've got a star who wants to play the part, you have to adapt the part to the star. Then there's choosing locations, choosing the heads of departments, the DP, the sound mixer, the production designer, crucial, finding the locations, all of that, and then shooting the film. Then after that, there's several months of editing, usually. So, you know, and then you, finally, you have to fight with the marketing department because they always want to make it differently from the way you imagined it. So the responsibilities of the director are pretty total. It takes something. I mean, I never made a film in less than 9 months from start to finish, and sometimes quite a lot more. If you count pre-production, post-production, marketing, and then finally publicity. So there we are.
Wow. Excellent.
That's what you do.
Wow.
And then on a day-to-day basis, you have to be very decisive. You have to get enough shot every single day. Films are scheduled by the day, and a day costs an agreed amount of money, depending on the size of the film and the crew. But most of my films would have been in the region of $100,000 a day. So you have to get what you plan to shoot that day done. or else you go into another day and then you're into another $100,000. And so all day you're trying to get it. You're trying not to rush anyone. You're trying not to hassle the actors. You're trying to get them to do their very best and keep it calm and smooth. But at the same time, you've got to get it done. And right behind you is standing the producer, and you can see the dollar signs clicking up behind his eyes. So, you know, that's what an average day is like.
Yes, sir. Way back in the day, you co-created with Anthony Jay, Yes Minister.
Yes.
A political satire show, which was, don't know how you feel about it, a favorite program of Margaret Thatcher, of all people.
Yes, of all people.
I'd love to know, where did the idea for that show come from, and what did you think of its reception? How it was received?
It came from Tony. Tony and I had worked together on various other things, and he said to me one day, how would you feel about doing a comedy series set in Whitehall in the corridors of power in London? And I said, I thought that sounded really boring, but I didn't do it. Well, 3 years later, I was looking for something to write. And I remember Tony had suggested that, and I found him, and I said, do you remember that idea? And he said, yes. I said, have you done anything with it? And he said, no. Do you want to? So we started researching it. So that's how it came about. How was it received? We expected it to be received in a very small way. You know, it doesn't have any of the ingredients of a popular television series. It's essentially three middle-aged men talking. There's no action. There's no sex. There's hardly any women. And we didn't imagine that it would be a success. We just thought, how great that the BBC's letting us do six episodes, and they'll go on at some ungodly hour when hardly anyone's watching, and we'll be pleased that we did it. Well, the opposite happened. It just took off like wildfire. Important politicians wrote feature articles in all the important newspapers saying, how did we know that this was what their life was like? Where were we getting all the information? Mrs. Thatcher demanded to see it because, of course, you couldn't. There was no internet and there were no DVDs in those days. There were no commercial tapes. So it was just the original BBC tapes. So Mrs. Thatcher demanded them and was told, well, she found out. She said, oh, it's number 10 here. We want to see, Mrs. Thatcher would like to see the first six episodes of Yes Minister. And we said, she can't. I'm sorry, the tapes are out. Who's got them? And the producer said, the Queen.
Wow.
And so after the Queen had them, Mrs. Thatcher watched them. She was crazy about it, which embarrassed me. Didn't embarrass Tony, because Tony was rather conservative, but it embarrassed me because I wasn't conservative. So I was at great pains to say that lots of other people who were not Tories liked the show. And then it just got bigger and bigger. It was sold to, I think, 80 countries. Mm-hmm. I wrote books based on the series, which were all top of the best-selling lists in Britain and in all other English-speaking countries except the United States. So it was a colossal success. And we emerged from our offices like bewildered moles, you know, puzzled by the fact that everyone suddenly loved this show. It was a good feeling.
Absolutely. Wonderful. Well, wow. That's extraordinary, Jonathan. Thank you. Can't wait to ask you this. This won't be a surprise to you because we've talked by email, but one of my all-time favorite movies is Clue, directed by you, of course, and written by you. I was obsessed with that movie growing up, and I still enjoy it. I watched it yesterday, as a matter of fact, pointed at your name on the credits when it came up. And my girlfriend and I, we saw the stage production of it just last year. There was one playing in town here. And I know it was your first movie. What was it like getting involved with Clue as a project?
Well, it was weird. I'd written a lot of TV shows. I directed a lot of theater. I never made a movie. Peter Goober, who at that time ran a company called Goober Peters Entertainment Company, he later became chairman of Sony, as you probably know. Anyway, he was planning to produce a film of Clue with actually Deborah Hill as the line producer and John Landis directing it. And for some reason, they came to me to write the script. I can only assume that somebody suggested me, an agent or something. And I discovered long afterwards that five other writers had been hired and departed from the project as they gave up. And it was really strange because most films are either original screenplays or they're based on a book or a play or a true story. But all of those things have characters. And as the novelist Graham Greene famously said, character is plot. Mm-hmm. Well, Clue didn't have any characters. Clue was a board game. It had a lot of colors, Miss Scarlet, Mr. Green, Professor Plum, but those are just colors. You know nothing about those people. So what I had was 9 rooms, 6 weapons, 6 colors to name characters, and something had to be made out of that, which was, it was a straitjacket. I couldn't change that. I couldn't change the rooms. I couldn't change the board game. I couldn't change the characters. I couldn't change the weapons. These were all given. So yeah, it was difficult to write. John Landis came up with a very good idea for a sort of rough plot, and he pitched it to me one day, which was very exciting because he sort of ran around his office and jumped on his desk and was full of energy and shouting and pretty funny. And at the end of this amazing pitch, he said, and then the butler says, "I know who did it." So I said, I was on the edge of my seat. I said, "Who did do it?" He said, "I don't know. That's why I need a writer." So, you know, basically I used some of the incidents that he had invented, but I had to start from the beginning and find out who these people are, you know, and why this all happens. I mean, it all had to be created. None of it's in the book yet.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely, Jonathan. Well, one bit of the movie that sort of fascinates me, the kind of, I'm being metaphorically here, background music of the whole movie is McCarthyism, right? We see it on we see it on the Cook's TV. Wadsworth mentions that his wife was blackmailed for having communist friends. Communism is just a red herring is a trope that we hear repeated throughout the film. Can you tell I've seen it once or twice? Why did you pick that particular period? Was there a special significance behind that?
Yes, a bunch of reasons. The country house murder mystery is a period idea. You know, Agatha Christie essentially invented them. They were very popular in the 30s, 40s, and 50s. People still do them occasionally, but, you know, things have moved on. But it had to be a country house murder mystery because it all takes place in one house and it's about a murder or more than one murder. So I felt that was sort of, that felt right as a period piece. Then added to that, I'm English, as you can probably tell. You know, I didn't know a lot about America. I'd never been to Hollywood before I made this film. I'd been to New York once or twice, but I mean, as a tourist, you know. So I had a friend called Donald Ogden Stewart, who you probably haven't heard of, and people don't remember anymore, but he was the first president of the Screenwriters Guild in the 1930s. He was very left-wing. He wrote a number of very famous films, including Philadelphia Story, which won the Oscar for best screenplay as film. I don't know if James Stewart and Catherine Hepburn won Oscars, but it won several Oscars. And he wrote about 70 other films. When McCarthy got control of America in the 50s, Don was asked to name names by the House Un-American Activities Committee. And he came to England. He refused to name names. He left America, and he never went back. Well, I got to know him through another show, a stage thing I did in England. And we used to talk about McCarthyism. And I met a lot of the people at his house who had been blacklisted because there were a lot of expatriate American filmmakers all over Europe who had been forced out. Charlie Chaplin, Waldo Salt, who wrote Midnight Cowboy, Ring Lardner, who wrote MASH, lots of them. And I met all these guys at his house. And so I was really an expert on the McCarthy period. So I used what I knew. And also, of course, it gave me the opportunities that I needed for a murder mystery because people have to be murdered for some reason. Again, it's character is plot. So there had to be some reason they were going to be victims. And they had to be victims because they were hiding something. And, you know, so, and also finally, I'm a very political person. I've written a lot of political stuff. So I enjoyed putting in political jokes because I thought a lot of young people, kids and people are going to like this film, I hope, if it goes well. But the grown-ups have got to have something for that. And so, you know, I suppose that's my complete answer.
Yeah, no, excellent. I'm really chomping at the bit, Jonathan, to talk dialogue with you. I love the dialogue in the movie. The one-liners, I always forget how quotable that movie is. You know, why is the car stopped? It's frightened, you know, for instance. And I'm curious, were there any sources in particular that you drew upon for the dialogue?
No, I invented it all. That's what writers do. I had a style that I wanted to do. I'd recently directed a play by a wonderful writer in England called Joe Orton, who wrote a play called Loot, which I directed in the West End, and it was a big hit. And he wrote very dark comedy in a very epigrammatic style. And I thought, that's what I need for Clue. I need dark comedy, but it's got to be funny.
Mm.
And it needs to be witty. That's it. So that's what I set out to do.
Sure. I couldn't quite forgive myself if I didn't ask you this, Jonathan. Do you have a particular favorite line from the movie?
No, I don't remember any of the lines from the movie. I would have to watch it again or see or read it again. I mean, I have a lot of lines in it that I like, but yeah. I don't remember offhand.
Gotcha.
Once I've done a project, you know, it goes out of my head and I move on and think about something new.
Yeah, I understand that. I'm curious about the three different endings. You know, was that your idea and what was the effect? I think you said on another podcast that you considered it a mistake, correct?
Yes, I did consider it a mistake. It was not my idea. It came from someone in the Goober Peters production office. I think they thought it would be a brilliant idea because Clue, the game Clue, can end in any number of ways, and so it should have multiple endings. They also thought, erroneously as it turned out, that if the film had three different endings, or was originally four different endings, people who would love the film would go four times to see all the endings. This was, as it turned out, the dumbest idea in movie history. Because what actually happened was that people saw that there were different endings in different theaters, and they didn't know which to go to, so they didn't go to any of them. And also it was a bad idea, because finally an ending is what a film is about.
Right.
And so it looked like we didn't know what the film was about. And I'd been pushing to put all the endings together as they are on the video, and I should have done, but I was exhausted from making my first film and from all the hassle, and I was commuting between London and LA during post because I was doing television series in England, and so I was greatly exhausted, and I foolishly stuck to the original plan, and I think, yes, it was a mistake, and I think that's why the film didn't do particularly well on its first release. And the fact that all the endings are there now is why it's done so well ever since.
Right. Yeah, I would agree with you. You know, the last act of the film, in my view, it may as well have been called The Tim Curry Show, right? He was brilliant in it.
Yeah.
I'd love to know what it was like directing those particular scenes and working with Tim Curry. Because I know you went to high school with him, right? You knew him.
Yeah, I was at high school with Tim. I knew him not that well, but we knew each other. He told me some years earlier, when I became an actor, that gave him the confidence to become an actor. People didn't become actors from our school. It wasn't like we went to that kind of school. So anyway, he was suggestive of the part, and I thought it was a wonderful idea. And how did I work with him? Well, the way you work with any actor. I mean, he comes in, he's done his homework, he knows the lines, and then we say, you know, have you thought of this? What about that? You know, you nudge actors in the direction you want them to go. You mention things they might not have thought of that could be helpful to them. You try to remain open to anything they bring to you that you hadn't thought of, which, of course, is a lot. I mean, there was no special difference working with Tim than with anybody else in that film or any other film.
Sure.
He's a very good actor.
Yeah, unquestionably. I could talk Clue with you all day, sir, but I have a lot of questions I wanted to get to, so I really appreciate it. When did you receive the project My Cousin Vinny? What was it like getting involved with that?
Well, after Clue was a failure at the box office, I couldn't get arrested. And I went back to England and I did more TV work. I directed at the National Theatre. And finally, I got Nuns on the Run going in England. Well, that went very well. Fox bought it and distributed it in America. And Joe Roth, who was chairman of Fox, liked it. So he gave me My Cousin Vinny and said, would I be interested? And I read the script and I really liked it. And so that's how I got involved with it.
Excellent. And then I'd love for you to be able to talk about directing that scene where Marissa Tomei goes through that whole "the defense is wrong" monologue. Can you recall that day by any chance?
Oh, yeah. It was more than one day.
Yeah. Of course.
Yes. What is it you would like to know about it?
Well, I'd like to know what sort of direction you gave her, if any, or did you just let her run with it?
Oh, gosh, I can't remember. It was 30 years ago.
Sure.
I mean, Marissa really knew how to play that part. She nailed it from day one. I don't think there was a take that we did in the whole day, in the whole shoot, which was about 40-something days. I don't think there was a take I couldn't use that she did. She was just superb. So I don't think there's anything I can tell you except that everything in the courtroom was very difficult to shoot because there was so much coverage required. I mean, you know what coverage is. If you don't know what coverage is all the other shots you have. You sometimes do a master of a scene, and that contains everything. But frequently you don't do that, because if the scene is too big, like the courtroom full of 100 people, you can't get that. I mean, they're tiny on the screen.
Sure.
Right? So you do two shots of Joe and Marissa. You do singles of both of them. You do shots of the jury's reactions. You do shots of the judge as he responds. You do shots of the prosecuting counsel and the sheriff. There's a tremendous amount of shots at different angles. So a scene like that takes really some time to shoot. And from the directing point of view, the tricky thing is that you don't want to always be shooting from the same angles, because that gets very boring. So it'll take place in that one courtroom. And so I had to plan the shots very, very carefully with the DP, Peter Demme, so that we were not repeating ourselves. So that we were, each scene in the courtroom was shot from a different point of view, essentially. From one side, from the other side, from the front, from the back. We had walls that fly in and out so that I could be behind the jury. So you record everything, you shoot everything from different angles. I had, you know, the wall behind the judge could go in and out and so forth. So it was a big operation shooting those courtroom scenes. And of course, I gave notes to Marissa or Joe sometimes, but I really can't remember what they were.
Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate it. So, you know, the movie's obviously been praised by many in the legal profession for its accuracy. I know you have a law degree from Cambridge.
Yeah.
Yes, sir. Did that in any way influence the decision to aspire to accuracy in the movie?
Yes. I was very concerned that it should be accurate. Dale Lorna, the writer, had done a lot of very good work, and a lot of it was already, you know, absolutely right. But there were scenes when, for instance, when the scene when he cross-examines Marissa, the one you were talking about, You can't cross-examine your own witness unless that witness refuses to cooperate, and you then apply to the judge and ask for her to be treated as a hostile witness. And so there were things like that. There was evidential technicalities involved because, you know, I knew a lot about the law of evidence. And so, you know, and I'd been to a lot of trials. So, yes, that was all a help. But I don't want to minimize what Dale Lorna did. I mean, he was, you know, it was mostly there in the script.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I'm curious, Jonathan, my last question on My Cousin Vinny, is there a particular memory that you have of filming that movie that you'd like to share?
A particular memory? I think a particular memory is the heat. We were shooting in the Deep South in Georgia. As we got towards the end of the shoot, it was approaching the summer. We didn't have a proper studio. We were in a huge corrugated iron shed with a tin roof, and the sun was beating down on it. And although we brought in temporary air conditioning, and although we gave all the actors little fans that they could hold up to their faces when we weren't shooting, the heat was overwhelming. It was like all those courtroom shots, it was like shooting in a sauna. And that was aggravated by the fact that we were under the flight path to Atlanta Airport. And, of course, we could hear all the airplanes because it wasn't a soundstage. It was a big corrugated iron warehouse. So I think that's my abiding memory, yes.
Interesting. I just have a couple questions left, Jonathan, then you're no longer my prisoner, okay?
Okay. I'll longer if you want, but carry on.
How did you get involved in directing The Whole Nine Yards?
You see, you never really know how these things happen. One of the producers, called Alan Kaufman, I think he'd seen one of my films, or all of my films, or I don't know, he suggested me. I was surprised because I didn't really know anyone else involved. I didn't know Alan. But obviously I was, you know, when I read the film, I found it entertaining. It needed quite a lot of work. I mean, we made it a lot funnier than the original script had been. But I thought it had huge possibilities. And it was being produced by a man called Eli Semaha, who was a Lebanese producer who owned Celebrity Cleaners, cleaning company all over L.A. And appropriately, lots of celebrities went to his cleaners, and he got to know them. Then he opened a bar and disco, or maybe it wasn't a disco, but a bar with a lot of music called, I think it was called the Roxy on Sunset. And some of the stars who he knew by this time were there, so he got to know them socially. And he came up with this idea, which was, he knew that every star had some film that they'd loved but had never got made. something that was in their bottom drawer. And he said to them, if you come to me with your projects that you want made and you'll star in them, I can raise the money and we'll make them. So they made 10 films that way, of which the only one that made any money was The Whole Nine Yards. And that didn't come about that way. What happened was that David Willis was trying to produce The Whole Nine Yards as a very low-budget film, and he gave it to his brother Bruce to see if Bruce would help him raise the money. And Bruce read it and said, oh, I'd like to play Jimmy the Tulip. So that meant the film could get financed. So this film that hadn't been able to be financed for ages was financed immediately by Ely Summer. And then we got Matthew Perry, who was, you know, hugely popular for Friends. And Ely had a deal to make the film in Montreal, make all his films in Montreal. Unfortunately, The Whole Nine Yards was set in Miami. And you can't find anything less like Miami than Montreal.
Right.
So I said to Ely, we can't shoot in Montreal. It's Miami. He said, I don't care what it is. That's where my deal is. Shoot it in Montreal. And the only way to do that was to rewrite it for Montreal. So we did. And so that's how it came about.
Wow. That's extraordinary.
That was your question, how did it come about?
Yeah, it was, Jonathan. I appreciate it very much. As you probably know, Matthew Perry just released his autobiography.
Yes.
Well, if it's okay, I'd like to quote something to you and get your thoughts on it. So he wrote about The Whole Nine Yards, obviously, A Whole Nine Yards. The director, Jonathan, who for some unknown reason I had taken to calling Sammy, ran the kind of set I love, a very creative one. The best joke, no matter where it came from, would be picked, just like we did on Friends, end quote. You have any initial thoughts or reactions?
Well, I'm glad he feels that. I think that's true. I could tell you why he called me Sammy.
Yeah, please.
I was standing on the corner with him one day with, I think it was with Bruce Willis and Kevin Pollak and Matthew, and autograph hunters approached our little group and wanted autographs from everybody. And Matthew knew that I wouldn't want to get into conversations about I was the director and, you know, and so forth. So he said, this is, you know, here, Bruce, he'll sign, and here, and this is my Uncle Sammy. So I became Uncle Sammy.
That's hilarious.
And yes, it was true. Matthew came in nearly every day with new funny ideas. He was wonderfully creative. You know, some of them I didn't like. Some of them didn't work. Some of them were wonderful and are in the film. We punched the film up a lot during the shoot. And Matthew and I seemed to have a sort of really good partnership on that. He was really creative. And I loved working with him. And I'm terribly sorry that he's had such a miserable life ever since. I didn't realize that he was an alcoholic. You know, I don't read gossip columns, and apparently other people who knew about Friends knew that, or maybe some people knew it. I didn't know it. And he used to like to go drinking every night after the shoot, and one of the things a director does is, you know, make all the actors feel comfortable. So whenever Matthew said, come, let's go out for the evening and have a few, I said yes. So I did. And I couldn't understand why the next morning, and I was fine, and Matthew occasionally would come in looking wrecked. Of course, what I hadn't understood was that he'd been drinking or using some drug all night. And when I finally understood that, it became clear to me during the shoot. I tried to get him to do less, but nobody can. You know, that's up to him. And he's had his book is really extraordinary, I think. Very interesting, very moving, well written.
Yeah.
I hope it goes very well, and I hope that he's got over his alcoholism, but I don't know that if he has or not. It's not clear from the book.
No, it isn't. But yeah, I would feel as you do. I wish him the best. What are you working on currently, Jonathan?
Well, I wrote a novel that came out 3 or 4 years ago called Samaritans, which is about what is laughingly known as the healthcare system in this country. And it's set in a hospital where the management, the board are very worried because it's beset by rising costs and poor management, and the CEO has just resigned, and they need to find a new CEO. And they hire the head of hotel operations from a Vegas casino because he knows about check-in, check-out, beds occupied, dinner served, and everything you need to make a large building with lots of beds run. The only problem is he's not remotely interested in healthcare. He's just interested in profit. So that is the satirical notion at the basis of the book. And in fact, when I was writing it, I discovered that this is more or less had happened. the head of the CEO of Caesar's Palace in Vegas, when it was going bankrupt, was hired by Aetna, which is one of the three biggest health insurance companies. So it turned out that my idea was actually plausible, which hadn't struck me before. Anyway, so the book came out. It got very nicely reviewed and received. And it was optioned to make a TV series. And I've just been writing a pilot for the TV series. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, wonderful. So, you know, Jonathan, I expect there's no real answer to this as such, but I am curious how you would describe your process as a director and as a writer.
That's such a hard thing to describe. You don't know where your ideas come from. I mean, as a writer, I'm talking, directing is different. As a writer, one day you read something, you see something, you see a newspaper story, somebody says something to you, something that you think, oh, there's a story in there. And then you go off by yourself, or I go off by myself, and I sit in my office, and I stare at a wall, and I stare out of the window, and I hope that some interesting new thoughts will come to me in connection with the original thought. And so I sort of slowly and painstakingly construct a story, and I do a lot of research. I mean, even for completely ridiculous, facetious films like Clue, of course, I researched McCarthyism and America in the 50s. And, you know, it's hard to describe. Then anyway, I try to write a rough story. I don't do a rigid outline the way some people do. I write an opening. I know what it's about, and I don't start writing till I know what the ending is. I have to know how it's going to work out. That may change by the time I've written it, but I can't start something without knowing where it's going, because that's really the point of it. So when I've got that, I usually just start writing and hoping that something will come into my head every day that's not boring. And every day for me, writing is a big new adventure. I don't really know what's going to happen. I don't know what the characters are going to say. I don't know what they're going to do. I don't know what's going to happen next. I have a rough idea, but it's an adventure. And occasionally, it doesn't go anywhere and I give it up. Harold Pinter, you know, great playwright and screenwriter. I used to know him a little. And he told me about a play that he was writing and that he stopped writing. And the reason was, he said, I stopped listening to the character. I'm not listening to the characters. Now, that's inexplicable to people who write with a sort of a structure and an outline. And a lot of people do that. And the film industry wants you to have a clear outline. I wrote a film once for Disney, and we'd had many, many meetings about what the exact structure of the film. And just before I started writing it, the producer phoned me up, and she said, I read about the scene in the library. And I said, I haven't written it yet. And she said, well, no, but, you know, the scene that we've talked about in the library, and I'm worried about. And I said, look, that scene, we've talked about it, but it may not be in the finished script. I may not write it. What? And I said, well, no, it depends what leads up to it. It depends how it goes. It depends how the characters have developed. It can't just be, it can't all be set in advance. Some people like to set it all in advance, but I don't. So then your other question was about directing.
Yes, sir.
What's my process with directing? I don't know how to answer that either. My process as a director. Well, it's what I really described to you earlier. You have to like the script. You have to see the possibilities. You have to have some kind of sense of how it will work visually, why it's dramatically interesting. Can you cast it? All of those questions. Can the money be raised? I mean, I've worked on many films where we couldn't raise the money. Now, good scripts. Not some by me, some by other people. But for some reason, they weren't considered commercial by the people who run this industry. And the process as a director is I like to rehearse. Some film people don't like to do that, but I think it makes life much, much easier. Sidney Lumet always rehearsed. Some directors do. I like to, partly because of my theatre background, I suppose, but partly because, how can I put this? When you're shooting, it's all about how much time you waste in the day, which I explained to you already. If you've rehearsed, the actors know what they're going to do in advance. They know where they're going to stand. They know what they're thinking. They're not going to come on the set at 7 o'clock in the morning and say, I don't understand this scene. What's my motivation?
Right.
You discussed all that in rehearsal. And if it didn't work for them, you changed it in rehearsal. So it also means if you rehearse that you can set up the cameras and the lights at 7 o'clock in the morning or whatever time you're starting. And if the actors are late or delayed in wardrobe or delayed in makeup or any other delay happens, we could go ahead without the morning rehearsal because they've already rehearsed it. So they can just come in, we walk through it, they don't have to give a performance. The result of all this is that you can shoot much, much faster. And that has two advantages. The first is that it saves a lot of money. You know, if you can shoot something in 35 days instead of 50 days, you can see that's a huge saving. And I do shoot pretty fast. I mean, the whole 9 yards, which you like, was shot in 34 days, which is very fast.
Yes.
But it's because we rehearsed for 10 days and the actors remembered the rehearsals and it was, you know, made it much, much easier. And there's another reason, which I was going to mention, but it's now slipped out of my mind. Speed. Well, yes. I mean, it's all about the cost and the speed. So how it rehearses, I think it makes it much easier for everybody. Now, some people don't like to rehearse. Joe Pesci doesn't like to rehearse. So have any rehearsals in advance for Vinny, because the director's job is to make everything, is to help everybody on the film to do their best work. So because Joe felt spontaneity was vital to him and he didn't want to rehearse in advance, we only rehearsed on the day of each scene. So, of course, it made the shoot somewhat longer.
Huh. Fascinating. Thank you, Jonathan. I appreciate it. I know you got to get going, Jonathan. Jonathan Lynn, this was such a pleasure. It was an honor. I've been looking forward to having this conversation for a long time, so I can't tell you how much I appreciate you taking time for me.
It's a pleasure to talk to you, Joshua, and thank you very much for asking me.
My pleasure. Thank you, Jonathan. I'll let you go. You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com. where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.